This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 92.
And the hierarchy is a proxy for value in a world that is not changing. When the world is not changing very fast, then you can work with the hierarchy because that hierarchy is there to deliver the value. If, however, the value shifts, and now this hierarchy, it doesn't deliver value like it used to, now you've got a problem, and you see hierarchies creaking all over the place as the external rate of change keeps getting faster and faster and faster. Change hits, value shifts, money moves, and unfortunately, people don't. Why? Because they're trapped in the hierarchy looking up to get ahead, because somehow value is up, but value isn't up. Value is out. It's there. And so how do we organize in order to be able to capture this moving value?
What does it mean to connect talent to value? How can you create click for your most critical roles? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. Hey everyone, if you've been listening to the podcast, then you know I'm incredibly passionate about inspiring and developing the next generation of HR leaders. But you may not know that I'm also passionate about speaking to and working with HR organizations to enhance their capabilities. In fact, one of the coolest things that's happened since I've launched the podcast is that several HR organizations have asked me to speak about the future of HR and support their efforts to develop their HR teams. It's been an incredible honor to work with these HR organizations, and I'm looking to have an even bigger impact in the future. If you'd like me to speak to your HR organization, or if I can ever be helpful in building the capability of your HR team, please reach out as I'd love to hear from you. I want to take a minute and thank this episode's sponsor, Deeper Signals. Deeper Signals is a modern scientific assessments platform that is revolutionizing the way organizations measure, manage, and develop their talent. I'm a big fan of their assessments because they accurately assess personality, motivation, and competencies in just 7 minutes. But don't take my word for it. You can try Deeper Signals Core Drivers Assessment for yourself. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod, that's future P-O-D, and take the Core Drivers Assessment for free. And with that, I want to introduce this week's guests, Sandy Ogg and Hein Knoppen. Sandy is the founder of CEO Works, a consulting firm specializing in leadership and talent consulting. And prior to starting CEO Works, Sandy worked as an operating partner in private equity at Blackstone Group, serving Blackstone's nearly 100 portfolio companies. Prior to Blackstone, he was the chief human resources officer for Unilever, where he overhauled Unilever's operating framework and leadership system. Sandy is also recognized as a fellow by the National Academy of Human Resources, the highest honor in our field. And while Sandy's achievements are many, he is well known for his talent-to-value methodology, which helps CEOs, CHROs, and executive teams gain clarity on the roles, work, and talent that are responsible for driving value creation. Joining Sandy is Hein. Hein has 35 years of leadership success in designing and implementing talent strategies as critical drivers of business performance. Prior to joining CEO Works, Hein served as a CHRO for ING Bank in Amsterdam, where he is responsible for the company-wide human resources management and people strategy for over 53,000 employees across 45 countries worldwide. Hein brings a strategic and pragmatic point of view to everything he does. And in my conversation with Sandy and Hein, we're going to discuss why the best leaders focus on the fewest things that can make the biggest difference, why companies can't just improve their way to success. Instead, they must always be transforming to win. Why companies must look beyond the traditional hierarchy to identify the roles that create value. Why focus and the conviction to say no are the keys to managing complexity. And how organizations can create click by aligning the role, the work, and the right level of resources with the right talent. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's get into my conversation with Sandy and Hein. Sandy, Hein, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you both?
Sandy is fine, and I'm fine as well. Sandy is right. We're doing great, JP. We're excited to be with you.
Yeah, precisely.
We're excited to have both of you on the podcast today. You both have had incredible careers as HR leaders, and now you're really helping CEOs and CHROs unlock talent to value. This is a really, really cool conversation. And honestly, you both have been on my list to be on the podcast for a while. But Sandy, let's start with you. You launched CEO Works in 2015 after being an operating partner for Blackstone and a CHRO for Unilever. What made you decide to start CEO Works, and what makes it different from other executive advisory firms?
To be perfectly honest, the reason I decided to start it in the beginning was just to have an outlet for my own imagination and creativity. I wanted to get ideas that had been rumbling around in my mind. I wanted to get them on paper and maybe out in the world. Maybe they could make a difference somewhere. And also as a way to spend time with friends working on cool stuff. So that was the impetus for it. And I had no thoughts that it would become a thing, but it's kind of become a thing.
Well, that's great. And you'd be able to recruit amazing HR talent, executive talent like Hein. And you joined in 2020, right? After a really successful career as an HR executive, most recently as a CHRO for ING. And this gives you what I call kind of that inside-outside perspective, because you're now an executive advisor, but you've been in the seat. You know kind of what's likely to be the boardroom, what executives are looking for, how do you create business value?
Yeah.
Tell us more about the insights around that, and what was it like inside to outside?
I spent the first 20 years of my career at Unilever, and I was instrumental in getting Sandy in as the chief HR officer. So Sandy and I got to know each other in the early 2000s, I think 2001, 2002. We developed a relationship on various levels. And one is the professional level. I was always really attracted and interested in Sandy's groundbreaking thinking. And the other thing, we had a great click as human beings. So we became friends and we kept in touch with each other. And then 8 years ago, Sandy started this conversation. Why don't you join me? And why don't you start building Europe? At that time, I'd only been in corporate life. And I had grand words about being responsible for your own career. But it felt a little frightening to say yes. And then we had some really good conversation. And that's how it started. So I joined Sandy early 2020, having known each other for close to 20 years. And I would not say to you, JP, that it has been easy, but it has been greatly rewarding so far. I feel like I'm in a new career. And so having been on the other side of the table, like that was for Sandy, we have a very particular relationship with our clients because we can say to them, we were at your side of the table. So we are not conventional consultants. That's what we like saying, of course. We are special. This is the short story.
Yeah. You know, JP, I think it's worth noting that when I arrived at Unilever, Hein was really the first person who took an interest in me. And because I showed up, my wife was 8 months pregnant and I was transitioning out of Motorola into Unilever. I was moving from a different city to a different continent into a new company and a new country. There were so many variables and so many different things. The kindness and real genuine help that Hein showed me at that point is something we as a family will never forget. And that's the basis of the friendship and the business partnership that we've developed.
That's great. And obviously that now has turned into being part of CEO Works, leveraging Sandy. And Sandy, you've been building out Europe, which is amazing. And I think for both of you, because you have the unique perspective that you've actually sit inside the seat, you know what it's like to be a senior CHRO and executive, and now you're out helping people to do that. What are some of the insights you've had going from that inside to outside perspective? Sandy, start with you on that.
When you're sitting in the chair inside a company, you are, of course, operating with a particular agenda that the organization is on. And in our case, when Hein and I were working together, and then we were actually serving Hein before Hein and I became partners. When you're sitting in that chair, you have a particular agenda and a particular transformation that you're working on. There are very concrete things that you need to get done with a set of people and within the context of a operating framework and a political system that you have to go and get that done. And so that sets up constraints in terms of what you can do and what the organization can actually digest. And so as the inside person, you really need to be able to keep in mind, how are we going to make progress against this agenda within the constraints that we have? When you're moving to the outside, you are trying to understand the best that you can what that set of conditions are, but you also have the benefit of working in a multiplicity of different sets of constraints and levels of awareness and digestion and all of that stuff that reside within the company. So you can bring perspective that says, hey, this looks bad, but it's not horrible. Or this looks good, but don't get overconfident. So you can help to calibrate. And when you get that, you need that inside outside combination anyway. One of the things I think that it differentiates us from some others is that we've been in those chairs, and therefore we're more willing and in some cases more able to have an appreciation for that and yet also look beyond it with, hey, there are some examples where people are addressing that differently or maybe even better that might be useful here. At the end of the day, you want to be useful and you want to help to achieve the goal, whatever the goal or the value creation agenda or whatever it is that you're working on.
And I would add to that. So Sandy, when you were at Motorola and when you joined Unilever, you had already a number of years of consultancy under the belt. For me, that was different. And so when I left corporate life and became your partner, what really struck me, and it's an essential challenge of big companies, how much time people in big companies are losing with activities that do not create value. And I was one of those. So we run programs and we run initiatives that make some people feel very good, particularly when they are in senior positions. And then it is very questionable whether it drives company performance. And I just had that conversation with Sandy a few weeks ago. Bob Sutton from Stanford University has written a beautiful book called The Friction Project. And one of the things he makes very clear is, with all great intentions, the leadership of big companies rob their management from the time they need to drive performance. And I'm afraid we've been doing that all. Back to your question, what strikes me and what I have found sobering experience is to see how much time is being lost with all great intention to work that may do a lot, but it does not improve company performance. This is my most important insight from the past few years. Would that make sense to you, Sandy?
Absolutely. Looking for the opportunity, JP, to work on the pure mixture. So what are the fewest things that if you could focus on them would make the biggest difference right now? And what are all of the distractions and irritants and things that come in the way of that?
Hey everyone, we'll be right back with more Sandy and Hein after a word from our sponsor. If you are a fan of the future of HR, then you know that I believe the organization with the best talent wins. So how do you ensure that you are selecting and developing the talent that will help your organization to win? The answer lies in using a scientific, data-driven approach to assessing and developing your talent, and that's where Deeper Signals comes in. Deeper Signals is a modern scientific assessment platform that is revolutionizing the way organizations measure, manage, and develop their talent. Why am I such a big fan of Deeper Signals? With Deeper Signals, you can accurately assess personality, motivation, and competencies in just 7 minutes. You can generate personalized action plans and development journeys that equip leaders, individuals, and teams with the insights needed to improve onboarding, help them grow, and increase their overall performance. And the best part, Deeper Signals is affordable, user-friendly, and scalable, making it accessible to organizations of all sizes. No wonder over 400,000 people from over 140 countries have completed their assessments, and companies like Caterpillar and S&P Global are loyal customers. But don't just take my word for it. You can try Deeper Signals Core Drivers Assessment for yourself. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod, that's future P-O-D, and take the Core Drivers Assessment for free. It's normally $65 per assessment, but Deeper Signals has agreed to give Future of HR listeners this limited-time opportunity to try the assessment risk-free. So what are you waiting for? Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod, P-O-D, and complete the 7-minute Core Drivers Assessment. I know you'll be impressed with the results. And with Deeper Signals, you'll have the scientific, data-driven approach you need to select, onboard, and develop the talent that'll help your organization to win today and into the future. But Sandy, you've worked on something called the talent to value. You kind of coined that term of talent to value. Explain more about this concept and what HR leaders should be really thinking about, because I think it does help you get to what really matters more than maybe what being requested.
Yeah, it's such an important question. So we go back in time a little bit. You can imagine me sitting in my role at Motorola, and I had a newly created job. I was the head of something called the Office of Leadership. And the Office of Leadership was something that was carved out. I reported directly to the CEO. I was also a part of the global HR team. And I was responsible for the top 200 roles and the top 1,000 talent. And my job was to reliably fill and prepare to fill the top 200 jobs with the best talent in the world. And I could never really understand HR in the beginning until it sort of came to me that it was really a core business process that was about talent supply and demand, or leadership supply and demand. And I actually ran a project in a large sort of management consultant, not an HR consult, but a large management consult, to map the process and test the best. What was the best in the world? Who was the best at what? And we looked at the world's best companies at the time. We cobbled together what was a leadership supply process, and we overlaid it on Motorola. And out of that came this new thing called the Office of Leadership. And we quite successfully regularly filled, and we created a profile for the role and a profile for the talent. And then we would match the role with the talent. So we had a profile of each one. The interesting part was the definition of top 200. Top 200 was starting with the CEO and then going to the CEO's direct reports and then going to their direct reports. And once you got to 200, you draw a line. Well, that is a traditional hierarchical view of it. And the hierarchy is a proxy for value in a world that is not changing. When the world is not changing very fast, then you can work with the hierarchy, because that hierarchy is there to deliver the value. If, however, the value shifts, and now this hierarchy, it doesn't deliver value like it used to, now you've got a problem. And you see hierarchies creaking all over the place as the external rate of change keeps getting faster and faster and faster. Change hits, value shifts, money moves, and unfortunately, people don't. Why? Because they're trapped in the hierarchy looking up to get ahead, because somehow value is up, but value isn't up. Value is out. It's there. And so how do we organize in order to be able to capture this moving value? We've really moved from a world. I was in Motorola, Six Sigma. You know, we were sort of the originators of continuous improvement, quality and Six Sigma and all that sort of stuff. Well, what's happened now, you can't continuously improve your way to victory if the value has shifted and it's over there. Now we need to continuously transform. So in a world of continuous transformation, you need new tools. There's new rules, you need new tools. And I would say that the fundamental difference here is we're not connecting talent. like here's the top 200 roles and here's the top 1,000 talent. We have to connect talent to value because the value is moving around. So when I arrived at Unilever, I realized that we were in a state of transformation and we needed to accelerate that transformation. When I started to look at, well, here is the value we have and here's the value we want. Our share price is sitting at 16 and not moving. We need to take it to 32. Well, what is it that is going to take the share price from 16 to 32? And I discovered we were perfectly organized and talented to deliver a $16 share price, but we were nowhere near organized or talented to deliver a $32 share price. So then you say, well, if we're going to 32, we're going to have to take places where we're over-talented in today's business and become more talented in tomorrow's. That was where we started then to say, well, gee, hey, hold on. The roles that are going to in a $32 share price are quite different. We created a new list of roles. It was not the CEO and then the CEOs. It was the talent where the value was. It was the roles where the value was that became important. And once we started to fill those roles with the best talent, the company began to transform. And we did that, ran that play a couple of times, and the rest is history.
That's an interesting story, Sandy. And here is one juicy anecdote, and we won't mention any names. In that process, you found out that building a haircare proposition would enhance the value much more than going on with our margarine business, which was not a value creator. It was a big cash machine, but not a value creator. And then in the haircare proposition, we had to compete to very, very big competitors. And then the initial original conventional thinking was we were going to send the young talents over there in that geography to build our haircare proposition, which is sort of asking a little David to fight Goliath. Now, David was happy, was lucky, but you won't be happy in the business environment if David, you have to fight the Goliath. And then we asked a very senior businessman who was on his way to the main board and asked him to go and build that business. And then 2 days later, he called the CEO and he said to the CEO, what in my life have I done wrong that you've asked me this? And so this guy had to be helped to just get the idea of, we are asking you to do something immensely more valuable than running a business as is. And it was a change of paradigm, I think, Sandy.
Absolutely. I answered your question, JP. It's such an important question.
I think you did. I think it is an important question. And I think you helped us understand, one, maybe it does work in some organizations where we do focus on the top 200 because the business is pretty stable. You know, maybe that business isn't really moving. And we do need to think about succession and building the bench around that. But what you're really saying, and I think everyone's feeling this, is that industries are constantly transforming. We're shifting, the value is shifting. And that means to continue to grow, we have to shift with that. And that means we have to understand the roles, the critical roles or strategic roles, whatever nomenclature you want for that, that actually do create the value. And it may not be in the hierarchy. It may be software developers and maybe AI developers now, you know, maybe something else we haven't thought about. That's going to really create that value. And then you're saying, get the right talent, get the right resources and put gasoline on that to get the growth.
Yeah, let's not misunderstand this. A hierarchy for an existing business is a very efficient way to manage your business. So that in itself is not wrong. The point is we have surrounded it with rituals that we have to ask ourselves whether they are still as useful as they were. We have a top 200 or a top 300. And there's nothing against a good party and good wine. I'm in favor. And there's nothing against having those people come together now and then. But the implicit expectation that that drives your business is by now a little naive. And that doesn't make those people less important, but have to see how importance for running your business as usual is different from criticality for creating new value. And that's the thinking we're trying to introduce in the companies.
And the paradox there is, they both matter, of course, having great leaders who then understand we have to shift value and put resources into different parts of the organization. That's really the key.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think, JP, you said something really important. It's not the one role, which, to use Heinz's example, is the leader of hair care. That is, by definition, a critical role. it was not a role that reported directly to the CEO. However, it was enormously valuable in terms of the kind of even latent potential and value that we had in Unilever at the time. However, it's not just a role that has one leader in it. There may also be roles, as you were saying before, you may have a company that data scientists, you know, if you take a company like UPS, for example, UPS is known for the drivers, and there are thousands, tens of thousands of these drivers. But those data scientists who sit and design the algorithms that determine where those trucks are going to go is the whole secret to their margin. And that may be a relative handful of people that are going to do that. And even if you have several hundred of them or several thousand of them in a company of hundreds of thousands, that role family stands out in something enormously valuable. Identifying the roles or the role families, the issue is when you overlay the value agenda on your organization, you will discover that it has measles. And you need to light up where the measles are.
Let's keep going down this path. I'm going to talk about talent. And I think, Sandy, you've also used the term click. And Hein, I've heard you use this as well, to describe the process of putting the right talent in the right roles to deliver value. Talk more about click. Like, how do you get that click to happen in your organization? What should we be thinking about?
Yeah, I think click is really important because of what's at stake. And if we take talent value, what happens is I get unclicked over here and I need to get clicked in over there. Now unclick, and now I'm in this state of something isn't right here. And then can I find where I can click in? So unclick, click. And so talent and value, when it works, you hear that sound like you're getting in your car and you're fastening the seatbelt. I'm now where I belong and I'm clicked in and I'm secure. Click. So talent, value, click. Good things can happen. But the issue is, what is the essence of the click? What is the fundamental way that stuff gets done? Well, stuff gets done when you have work, and when you're in a transformation, it's often new work. So what is the work? What has to get done? And it may not be what I used to do. Now there's new work. Then we have a role. And a role is a package of goodies that I get from the company and the operating framework and so forth. It's a bag of goodies that I get in order to be able to complete the assignment. So I've been given assignment. I've got new work. In order to complete the assignment, I've been given stuff. Do I have the authority to do it? Do I have the resources to do it? It's almost like I've got a kit and I'm handed a backpack with a new kit in it. And I've got new work and now I've got this kit that I'm bringing to the party. And we've got to ensure that we have enough in the kit to be able to do it. And then you say, okay, we got this new work and we got this new role. But then what about the talent? Is the talent, or am I ready to be able to complete that new work with this kit, with the kit I've been given? Or does the kit somehow need modification in order for me to be able to do it? And the click is this very interesting thing that occurs when the work and the role and the talent click. They come together, and we've all had that feeling. You think for a second about the best job you've ever had. You'll find a click there. You think about the worst job you've ever had. You'll find unclick there. And what happens when there is no click? Well, what leaks on the business side is value. No click, no value. But what leaks on the personal side is dignity. Dignity leaks. Forget engagement for a minute. If there's no click, there's no way for me to be engaged. And too often, we put all the burden on the talent. Oh, well, if the work is doable or not doable, doesn't matter. Try harder. Or you weren't smart enough, or you weren't this. And then if my kit is inadequate, I'm missing pieces there. Well, that's your problem. Go tin cupping around or trolling around to get it.
So it's on me. Superhuman talent might be able to do this undoable task with an incomplete kit. However, if we want it to happen quickly and effectively, then we're going to look at all three of those variables. We're going to create that very nice sound. Click. Boom.
And there's a few things to add here, Sandy, which is what we have found out over the years is we have always in conventional talent management be, as can I say, over-indexing on the individual and under-indexing on the role. And we've been terribly vague about what essential deliverables in the role were and the essential risks to be mitigated. Look at whatever job descriptions we asked the headhunter to work with. Pages, word flurries, vague, big. And then, so those typically, those documents that allow you to accept every candidate or refuse every candidate. So what we're seeing is this click idea is dependent on utter clarity about a few things that are relevant for the work to be done. And what we see is there is only so much that matters there. And people can be awfully poor at a few things. And if that is not critical for the role to be done, just live blissfully with it. And because of that lack of clarity about what is important, people that judge incumbents easily change their minds with, because if you don't know what you're looking for, everything is right or everything is wrong. And that's, I think, in the sense, so part of your click thinking, Sandy.
Yeah. Here's a fun, but sort of maybe simplistic example, JP. Have you ever built a Lego?
Sure. Poorly, but I built Legos.
Okay. Doesn't matter if you haven't built a Lego, it's an important part of your new job. So an important part of your new job is building Lego. You're going to build a Lego of the Taj Mahal. It's got 3,000 pieces, and you have to do it in 1 hour. It comes with a very nice box that's got a picture of the Taj Mahal on it. And inside the box are packets of Lego bits, numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and a set of instructions. All right. So we've got a job. We got an assignment. The assignment is build the Taj Mahal in Legos in 1 hour. The kit you've been given has 6 packs of bits of Legos. And then we have JP, the talent. We say, okay, JP, normally this 3,000 piece Lego might take a 12-year-old 7 hours. We know none of us are as talented as most 12-year-olds. And so then we say, okay, we've got the assignment. That's the work. We've got the kit. The only problem is one of the 8 packets was left out of the kit. But JP, you've learned how to do so much with so little for so long that you can do anything with nothing. So then the question is work, role, talent, click. So how do you feel at this moment? And if that was a real assignment and not a kind of, oh, well, we just sort of made this up on the spot, how would you feel?
Well, I think you're going to feel really you're being set up for failure, right? And I think a lot of people feel that way in organizations when they get all this extra work, these new expectations, when a lot of times they feel like, hey, the executives or whoever decided that that was what was going to happen, haven't thought through all the things to make it click, to your point. Yeah. So it's a great example, Sandy.
Well, yeah. And, you know, you think of one a little, maybe just a little bit more on the serious side. The assignment is to capture or whatever Bin Laden. And just imagine that the kit that SEAL Team 6 is given in order to be able to do it and the readiness of the talent to go do it. When you think about how hard that job was or is, it's a really, really hard assignment, but they were thoughtful enough in terms of the kit. Imagine the kit that they get to go do it. And then you think about the readiness of the talent and so on and so forth. You could probably say, okay, I can see a click there. But so often you would exactly that feeling that we have is this is just not set up in the right way. And then the question is, what can I do to influence, or what can we do to influence the work and the role? Because we're not always given everything we want, but how do we get closer and closer to a click? And I think clicks are going to replace engagement. It's not whether I'm engaged or not. It's whether I'm clicked or not, because then I can be successful. And fun and dignity and everything is rooted in success.
Such an important topic and conversation, Sandy. Thanks for giving both those examples. And I'm curious, maybe we go back, Hein, because what can executives do to make sure we've thought this through? And I agree with you that when we think about role profiles, we spend a lot of time like looking at the candidate list versus actually saying, what are the 3 to 5 most critical outcomes this role has to deliver? Because that's the hard work up front. And I think that happens a lot in these click situations. But what can executives do? What can HR leaders be doing to help make click happen?
This is an essential question. I've got a few thoughts here. In our experience, when we sit with the CEO and help them to boil down their value creation plan or their strategy to the 4 or 5 spots where invariably 75-80% of the value sits, they do not find that very difficult because they know their business. And then you have to align your top team around the focus following from this exercise. And that is endlessly difficult because it is much more comfortable for an executive to give in to yet another priority. Someone around the board table says, yeah, well, I'm totally in agreement, but this needs to be done as well. It's much easier to say, okay, well, that you have that, we will add to the priority list than to have the constructive conflict. Sorry, we're not going to have this. And the same holds when you select people, particularly when there are 3 or 4 people involved. And what in hindsight I've seen as a pattern is the 3 people would have to agree about what really matters for that role, and they don't. What follows is a very long list. And it does take some straight back, and it does take a bit of character to say, sorry, we're not having this. If I have a list of requirements for a role that I cannot just remember from my head, then it's too long. So the first thing, but it's so almost counterintuitive, because in organizations, you like to remain friends, and there's important people, and everyone has their point of view, and you get to a very long list of requirements that have to be met, and that allows you to either recruit every candidate or to decline every candidate. So the first thing is really a matter of conviction, a conviction with the leader. There are only a few things that are relevant for this job to deliver, and that's what we'll focus on. That's the first thing. But that alignment thing, JP, as I've experienced it, is much more difficult than the pretty intellectual focus thing. What's your view, Sandy? Have you got other thoughts here?
JP, one of the things I love about working with Hein is he talks often about complexity. And we have companies that have in their leadership profile, does this person have the ability to master complexity?
Yeah.
The issue is, and I see at the beginning of every transformation, there is something in there that relates to productivity, which is doing more with less, right? We're trying to do more with less, and we use technology and so forth. The untapped area is most of our productivity tools are hierarchy based. So we look at spans and layers and say, well, how much management do we need? And then we look at all the things that the people are being asked to manage.
Yeah.
But if you go back to the principle that if we actually connect talent to value and we can create clicks, you can count the clicks, and therefore you can reduce the complexity in the organization, not by a little, but by a lot, because there is so much work going on that it doesn't matter. So much work going on, and we don't really get at the work because we have work happening everywhere. We're more than happy to manage the number of managers in a spans and layers exercise, but we're not really looking at the work or the role. The kit, if you start to look at the work and the kit, the kind of productivity gains that you can get are substantial. I mean, really substantial.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, you say, talking about productivity, right? Doing more with less. What I really hear you saying is we should do less and do it better.
Yeah.
That focus is what you're really trying to get to.
Yeah.
And alignment. Yeah. And it does go against how organizations are set up. We get rewarded for having bigger teams, bigger initiatives, more budget. But that doesn't actually maybe connect to value, is what you're here saying.
And we do need to be leaner, but the issue is not being lean, leaner and stronger where it matters. So if we can understand where we need to be strong and we want to muscle up and where we need to be leaner, you know, think about any of us, our experience of ourselves, We all want to be leaner and stronger where it matters. But most of these programs, we go lean. Okay, lean, that's good. Let's get lean. But in the process of getting lean, if we do a bog standard sort of exercise and we slice our way to greatness, we are very likely to get leaner and weaker. And that's a tragedy. We should get leaner and stronger.
Yeah. And Sandy, there's one more thing I've come to increasingly realize, which is in the complexity and in the multitude, under the multitude of challenges that a leader is faced with, you need some intellectual ability and all of that. But what I've come to realize, Sandy, is there is an element of conviction in your gut, sheer heart conviction, like a steely conviction. Sorry, I'm not having this because I'm having it this and that. You will only get to if you have suffered from all the failings of complexity. So I've come to see that this idea of conviction, where a CEO says to you, that's a great idea and we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it because it does not create value. So there is this additional element of that hard, steely conviction that enables you as a leader to resist all the temptation of giving in to extra demands and extra requests. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, this has been a terrific conversation. So I've got one last question for both of you. I think we could go on for a long time, but I can't let us do that because I know we all have commitments. So my last question for you, Sandy and Hein, is what is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
You go first, Sandy, because you're the wise guy here.
The short wind-up to this would be, I think Dave Ulrich brought to HR a new way of thinking about how we're organized into transactions, expertise, and business partners. That was a great contribution. The thing that is going to take the profession forward is the work has to change. In other words, the work of HR must change. And we have to redefine the work. And if the work is different, new work, new tools. Now, of course, you would expect me to say that if you sum it all down to one word, I would say click.
That's
role,
good.
Work, talent, click, boom.
Yeah. And I would say, in addition to that, talking about HR and the future, the question is, do you wish to follow business or do you wish to drive business? Sandy's click thinking is elegant and very succinct, and I like it. But there is something with HR we have to ask ourselves. Are we just going to follow business? Are we going to give in to all kinds of hobbies and give in to all kinds of solutions that are in search of a problem? Or are we going to drive business? That's what I think will define our future.
I love it. Click and driving the business in the future. Yep. Sandy Hein, thank you so much for being on the Future of HR podcast. This is an incredible conversation.
Thanks a lot, JP. And thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us, JP.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Sandy and Hein for sharing their perspectives and how to connect talent to value. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe or share our podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Matt Bean. Matt is an assistant professor in the Technology Management Department at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a digital fellow with Stanford's Digital Economy Lab and MIT's Institute for the Digital Economy. Matt does field research on work involving robots and AI to uncover systemic positive exceptions that we can use across the broader world of work. He's published in top management journals such as the Administrative Science Quarterly and Harvard Business Review, and spoken on the TED stage. Matt and I will be talking about his new book, The Skill Code, How to Save Human Ability in the Age of Intelligent Machines, why he believes we are sacrificing learning for productivity with new technology like generative AI and robotics, and why the three C's, challenge, complexity, and connection, are the basic components of how we develop our most valuable skills, and much, much more. This was an insightful conversation and one that you won't want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.